AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show on another one of our brand new to you shows. Great interviews we recorded. You've not heard these, and we have a humdinger of a show for you today. When Republicans were progressive, former Senator Dave Durenberger joins us. We're going to talk about his book, an incredible book, and it will remind you that many Democrats at one point used to vote Republicans because the Republicans weren't on the crazy train. The former senator, a sensational interview. And then coming up afterwards, Peter Callahan is joining us. He is the state reporter for MinnPost. We have a wrap-up of what happened statewide in 2018 and a brief look ahead for what's possibly going to happen with the Democrats in 2019. We'll take a break. Come on back with former Senator Dave Durenberger. When we return, it is the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.
Who's your most trusted companion? Who's with you 24/7? What do you never leave home without? Your phone, but the screen is shattered. Don't panic. Bring it to Computer Revolution with cell phone repair. We have over 18 years experience fixing computer devices, all brands, all carriers. We'll replace that screen and have it back same day. Computer Revolution with cell phone repair in Roseville at Highway 36 in Fairview. Or call 651-633-6600. We fix phones same day, 7 days a week.
It's the best time of the year. Toyota-thon is on. Rudy Luther Toyota has the 2019 models in stock, and to make room, the 2018s have to go. There are huge incentives from Toyota, and on top of that, Rudy Luther has additional huge discounts. And remember, you get my favorite perk from Rudy Luther, the Luther Advantage Card, which gets you 10 cents off per gallon at Holiday Station stores for 3 years with every vehicle purchase. Rudy Luther Toyota-thon is on. Stop in today. The southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
Hey Minnesota, Norman Goldman here. Catch me live every weeknight from 5 to 8 p.m. right here on AM 950. Whether it's a recap of the day's news, legal analysis, or teaching civics, justice is always served on the Norman Goldman Show. Today on the show, we hope you had a great Christmas holiday. We are back. We are live. I am here. We're in studio. You know crazy stuff is happening. Let's check in and see where we are.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. My next guest is a very recognizable name in the state of Minnesota. Senator Dave Durenberger is joining us. He's got a book out, When Republicans Were Progressive. He wrote it with Laurie Sturdivant from the Star Tribune. He's kind enough today to talk to us about this book and a little bit about the last 100 years of the Republican Party in Minnesota. Senator, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
I appreciate being asked to do it.
I have to, first of all, commend you. This is a gutsy book to write because I've interviewed Governor Arne Carlson a few times. And, you know, he is a throwback to what you refer to in your book, you know, kind of, you know, a fiscal conservative, socially more liberal Republican who does not mind speaking, you know, what he thinks. And he has been blacklisted by his party. He's been run out of the party. It is something where any kind of criticism of the modern Republican Party is not really tolerated. So for you to write this book, I mean, this is a big statement by yourself.
Yeah, but it doesn't change the fact that I still feel like I am a Republican, and I still feel like I'm a Minnesota Republican, and I believe, you know, I wrote the book in the hopes that we're coming back, and it's just a question of time and how we can reach that vast middle of Minnesota politics and convince them that there's a lot better use for both Republican and Democratic parties than we're using them for today.
Well, and to give you an idea, back when in the 80s, I used to vote Republican. This modern idea. I mean, I know there's sometimes Republicans come on the air with me and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, this far right loony lefty. Now, I used to vote Republican all the time. And because there used to be much more of a discussion of ideas as opposed to an ideology.
You have it exactly. That's exactly what it is. And it was encouraged by people in leadership positions in our state, whether it was faith-based leadership or it was political or governmental or business. We were in the business as a state, and we always have been, of trying to promote the common interest. And one of the ways you do that as society advances and the economy changes and circumstances change in every community is by how we use government and how we use it at specific roles.
You start your book out, you kind of started in late 1930s. Why did you focus on that as your beginning?
Because Minnesota is a traditional Republican state, a fairly conservative Republican right from 1860 on. And in our state, we elected many more Republicans than we did either Democrats or farmer laborites. But things changed in the Depression, and Minnesota's leaders were either strong farmer laborites, even some communists involved in the state of Minnesota in the midst of the Depression. And a young Republican lawyer from South St. Paul, Minnesota, named Harold Sasson, at age 30, decided he was going to run for governor. At age 31, he was elected governor by the biggest margin in the history of Minnesota. And he called himself, when running and when elected, he called himself a liberal, because he said his theory was government can do better than it's doing. And so can Minnesotans do better if they redefine the role that they want their institutions to play.
It is a very smart play, and he understood the playing field as it was, because let's face it, as you talked about, you're right, communism and other far left parties were making a rise in this country, because I think that the Republican Party of the 1920s, you know, it got to a point, it got very corrupted, and which, you know, in part led to the Great Depression. And so it was kind of like this: we've learned our lesson, we understand what we need to do. And of course, obviously, these Republicans living through the Great Depression, I mean, that affected everyone. I mean, they understood the larger role and really did a fine course correction as they headed in towards World War II.
Interestingly, the Republicans of the 19th century got the message from a Republican from New York by the name of Teddy Roosevelt. And he's the first person to call himself a progressive. And he said, we can't just run the economy. The economy itself, the business community, and the finance community is not the be-all and the end-all of the future of this country. There's people, too. And that's how the progressive movement began, and it ended by the start of the First World War, and then came back in the form of Harold Sasson in Minnesota and a variety of people in other states in the country.
And Sasson's impact was immediate. The Republicans really kind of rallied around that, and basically got themselves into, you know, and resonated throughout the entire state because of that new Teddy Roosevelt influenced direction.
And I think it's because it's all about leadership in Minnesota. We're used to not being led, but having people to look up to. As our models in Minnesota, and that's true at the local level, and it's true at the state national level as well. And Sasson set that mold perfectly, and he took on, he took on support for going to war against Nazi Germany in a state that was basically isolationist because of where so many of its people came from. They didn't want to go back to war again. But he took that one on, and he took on, he became the key of the United Nations. He became the key. He sat next to Admiral Halsey on the battleship in Tokyo Harbor, taking the Emperor Hirohito's surrender. He went up in the northern part of Japan and opened up a prison that had a whole bunch of people in it, Americans, including Minnesotans who were captured in Bataan in the Philippines at the start of the Second World War. He was an unusually gifted younger person, but he was a leader, and that's what Minnesotans respond to.
Progressive doesn't cut it. I mean, there is a stunning photo in this book from 1948 at the State Fair, which the Republicans put out here, and I've not seen a poster like this earlier than this. This is probably going to be one of the first ones. And the poster reads, "Prejudice in our town, what's that? Keep our children free from racial and religious hate." On the Governor's Interracial Commission, an astounding, outstanding, as well, statement to be made by the Republican Party. A statement today, which I'm convinced that billboard today would not be welcomed at the State Fair booth for the modern Republicans. But back then, it was this idea that you truly were progressives. It was wonderful.
Yes, and what's really interesting, and you're choosing that example, is it may not be what the so-called Republican Party is today, but and would be rejected in their booth because they own the booth, whatever that means. But for Minnesotans, it's more powerful today than it's ever been. This, not just the theory that all men and women are created equal, but the fact. And we've had that experience because of the Stassens and the Youngdahls and the Elmer Andersons and Levanders and Quees and Carlsons and all the rest of the people that led us in the state level.
There is an interesting when the Dixiecrats came on out, and basically they this change, and they all left and they went to the Republicans, because of changes in the 1960s. Minnesota seemed to not go down that path. Why do you feel as if, was it just the fact that the Republican Party in Minnesota was much more independent from a national party standard?
Yeah, that it always has been, and that's true of many states in the country. We are not all the same in the United States of America. It depends on where the colonists came from, the original 13 colonies. Where did they come from, and why did they come here? Was it religious persecution? Was it something else? And whatever the values they brought here from the old country, so to speak, including the Scandinavians and Germans and so forth that came, later on, they kept those values, and they passed those values on to their kids. They passed their values on to their communities. They passed their values on to the institutions that they created, and they're still here. That's the experience of going to the United States Synod, as I did. You find that that's true of America. We are one nation in the sense of bringing people together, but we're not the same people in terms of values. Whether you go to the north, south, east, west, you're going to find strong progressives in some parts of the country. You're going to find more traditional conservatives, if you will, in other parts of the country.
We're talking right now with Senator Dave Durenberger. The book is When Republicans Were Progressives. You get into the 60s. I often have said that one of the greatest displays of a competent, functioning government was Minnesota, in my mind at least, from the 60s in towards really the 80s. We actually had... There was agreement, there was an understanding that there was a larger issue here. You had party ideals, but you also had the willingness and to work together. You talk about this for the Republican Party, you get in towards the heyday of it all. Talk a little bit about why that worked so well when I think then the rest of the, like I said, the Republican Party on the national level was starting to change. It really actually, we ended up having a brilliant government here in Minnesota for a little over a decade plus.
Yeah, because on purpose, we said we are not, the Confederacy. We are not, there just shouldn't be such a thing. There can be a national branch of a political party, but when you get it down to the state level in this country, the national party benefits from this variety that we are as states and as people in states and in regions of the country. And we sort out our leaders in that respect, and we choose the leaders that have been most successful in bringing people together rather than the leaders that divide the country on the basis of some archaic philosophy of government. And that we enshrined in 1975 after President Nixon was forced to resign by changing the corporate name of the party to Independent Republican Party of Minnesota. We hung on to that for 20 years until the new right in Minnesota, whatever it might be called, was successful in taking over the Minnesota Republican Party, and they changed the name back to Republican Party, meaning there was no distinguishing Minnesota from Mississippi.
And when you bring that up, I mean, that's one of the things I think it really was interesting. It was such a mature and independent response to this desire by a direction on a national level. And that was back then, that was kind of true bravery. Although I think, when you look at it comparatively today, I don't know if really a party would have the guts, a state party would have the guts to do what you guys did back in the 70s.
Probably not. I think they have the potential for doing it, but right now the challenge is, what's the political party? I mean, how many people still go to precinct caucuses? How many people know what the precinct caucus was, what it produced in the past? It was the town hall meeting that we inherited from some of our New England forebears.
Mm-hmm.
The town hall meeting was where people got together once a year, and they talked about their community, and they talked about how they could improve their community. That we call that the precinct caucus. The precinct caucuses in 1966 produced a platform, which two-thirds of which was translated into law by a two-thirds majority of Republicans, called conservatives then, in the state legislature. It included the nation's first Department of Human Rights, one of the first pollution control agencies, or specific environmental agencies, the Department of Labor and Industry, showing that they're equal in their capacity to turn the value of the economy into opportunity for people in the state. The Metropolitan Council, Metropolitan Sewer Commission, a variety of ways that Minnesotans together, working across the aisle, as they say, but starting back there in the town hall meeting called the Precinct Caucus, actually were able to express what it is that was important to us as a people. That was the function of a political party. It ought to be again. But it's not.
Well, and it's interesting you bring that up, because we just have the news story right now. We have four Republicans who have left the Republican caucus in the Minnesota House, and they've formed their own caucus. And part of their rationale is that we're tired of one guy telling us how to vote. And I frankly, the idea of something like that, I imagine back then, you guys would have been livid if someone came forward and said, you need to do what I have to do. You guys would have run them out of office yourselves.
Well, you know, The way in which in a legislative body, whether it's at the state level or the national level, the leaders are able to articulate what the members express. And what those four people are saying is, we have no way to express ourselves and the people we represent in Minnesota if our leader tells us, we're going to be against this tax bill. We're going to be against this environmental legislation. We're going to be against the gas tax for transportation to help out rural and greater Minnesota. You know, if we're told how to vote by somebody from some other part of the state that happens to be the, quote, majority leader, that's not going to work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the genius, as we will probably get into, of the Senate I served in, was our leaders were able to express the consensus that we brought to the table, not just among ourselves as Republicans, but across the aisle, so to speak, with like-minded Democrats from states like ours.
I think about Pawlenty when he ran those five Republicans out that dared to go against him to override his veto. And just that's the kind of thing. It's like, that was kind of the end of it, is that your independent thought didn't exist anymore if you basically went against the whoever was the determined leader there. You one of your elements, and you talk about this in the book, that I really loved about you, is that you challenged Reagan. And I mean, in this day and age where you have a far less competent, person in the White House today than Reagan was, and yet no one in the Republican Party even wants to challenge him. Even they're trying to shut down even any investigation. Here you were in a country where, I mean, at times Reagan's popularity wasn't as high as it was, but you didn't have any problem going out there and looking at the president and saying, you know what, this isn't right. I need to see what's going on here.
As a fact of the matter, there's no way to compare Ronald Reagan with Donald Trump. You know, no way in God's green earth. I wish Ronald Reagan were back today. Did we disagree with President Reagan? Of course. And then our leaders would express it. Howard Baker first, and then Bob Dole, who succeeded them. And Bob Dole told me, he says repeatedly, if we couldn't get the votes that the president wanted or needed for his legislation, you know, one of us, the leader, would have to call the president and tell him we don't have the votes because we can't draw Democrats across or whatever the case may be. And President Reagan, to his credit, would say, you know, Bob, don't worry about it. You know, we're batting 72% right now, and that's not half bad. You know? he had an attitude, you know, that enabled him to take disappointment as well as victory, which you sure can't say about every president, and particularly the one we have now. That's what made us as Republicans effective, both in the Reagan presidency and in the Bush presidency that followed.
And by the way, I should mention U.S. Senator Bob Dole does write a nice little blurb about the book here, so it should be mentioned that. Let's talk about when this changed. I mean, I know you point towards, you know, Newt Gingrich, Contract with America, the rise of, I mean, I know that there's a lot of ideological media out there, guilty as charged, but, I mean, at the same time, I mean, where this all began was with Fox News and this no Democrat was ever right, no Republican was ever wrong kind of news that was being put out there. That was also the early 1990s, and that was really where things started to change. Is that really where you feel the state party as well started to get morphed into something that did not, you know, look anything like the independent Republicans?
Trying to get to the heart of it, it goes back to the war, you know, between the North and the South. And when I arrived in the United States Senate in 1978, the person who turned out to be the person with whom I voted least often during my career, 16 years in the Senate, was a Republican. It's Senator Jesse Helms from North Carolina. Jesse Helms got to the United States Senate as a radio talk guy, and not like you.
I have no intention. Never going to run for office. Never going to run for office.
No, but Jesse preached hate and differences and getting even and keeping good people out of office if they didn't qualify X, Y, Z. And he did it in a nefarious ways that I describe in the book. But he was the first, but he wasn't the last. He had amendments that went, the votes went out to 25 million people. He began this movement of negativity and anti-this, that, or the other thing, and the people that don't agree with me are bad people. And it just, by the time we got to the George H.W. Bush period, when we had this, Republicans were known for the no new taxes, that sort of thing, and George Bush moved his lips, and, you know, all that famous stuff that's been written about recently. He moved his lips to save the country and its economy on a whole, and millions of people that were affected by it. If he hadn't moved his lips, he might have been saving himself, but that wasn't George Bush. It was the Jesse Helms. It was the people that have succeeded him in Minnesota and in every one of the states, by building the capacity to talk no talk or negative talk or anti-talk or what's wrong with this, what's wrong with that, rather than coming up with solutions to problems.
Yeah, I love the story, and with the recent passing of George H.W. Bush, I remember the story of him. Well, Ralph Reed came apparently knocking and said, hey, make us part of your cabinet, and we'll be the loyalist foot soldiers you ever had. And he kicked him out. He said, if we ever allow those clowns into this administration, we'll never get them out of the White House. And it was actually, you know, when you think about it, because things really did change a lot. And when you look at even down to Tim Pawlenty or Kurt Dowd and how they manage when they are in charge, it really is a far cry, and it's nothing. I mean, when I grew up with Republicans like you, who I agreed with, I would say, more often than I agree with some Democrats. And yet that just doesn't seem to exist anymore, and that's a real sad element of our politics in this country.
Right. We didn't do it in the book on purpose. We talked about how we got the party left us, Republicans, mm-hmm. you know, and became somebody else's party, basically. But we didn't describe this impact on people like Norm Coleman and Tim Pawlenty and people that have been my friends for a long time. But you and I both, even though we may differ on some things, you and I both can watch the careers of, you know, this wonderful mayor of St. Paul who became a candidate for governor, and then the White House told him he had to run for the Senate, and this nice boy from South St. Paul, you know, who used to work for me, as a matter of fact, Tim Pawlenty, who wanted to run for the Senate seat held by Paul Wellstone, and was, you know, was told by the White House, you know, you got to get out of that job, leave it to Norm Coleman, and you got to run for governor. And you know, it was it's just a different time, you know, and a different result, moving people from who they really were, Coleman or Pawlenty or whoever you choose, to what they were told was the right thing to be.
Senator, talking with you, I'm reminded again of why I liked you so much. And as a guy that does host a liberal talk show, the fact that I can say to myself, I agreed with you on so many things. I had admired you. I liked you. The reality is what you've done here is, I think, a brave book. I think it's an excellent book. And I think it's something that people should all go by, because it should remind us, as we had so many constituents out when people would go door knocking this last election cycle, and they'd say, what I miss most is bipartisanship. I miss people working together. That I'm tired of stuff like Omnibus Prime, that I want to have, a dialogue that's disappeared. You remind me of the time when dialogue was the main goal, and that was a wonderful time in politics in America.
And I wrote the book because I believe it's possible again. And I look now at current events like Tim Walz being elected president or governor of Minnesota, and I say, if they've got a Tim Walz, we can have a Tim Walz. That's who we are in Minnesota. We just got to shed the impression that we've been giving people, and shed some of the people that pay for those impressions, and take back the party. And this book is a way to determine what kind of a party would you want in Minnesota, because it was successful at creating opportunities for leadership.
When Republicans were progressive, Senator Dave Durenberger with Laurier Sturdivant. It's an excellent book. Thank you very much. I so appreciate the time. All my best with the book, and I hope to have you back sometime.
Thanks very much. Anytime I can do it, I'd be happy to do it.
Thank you, Senator. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
What kind of a jackass would let an animal pick their insurance? Did you really think a lizard could save you money on car insurance? Would you let a duck pick your health policy? Insurance can be a zoo, but this is ridiculous. What you really need is an insurance agent that isn't looking out for the insurance companies. You need Cheryl at Array, an independent agent with 30 years experience looking for the best rate possible. Quit monkeying around and call 763-504-3067. That's 763-504-3067 for Cheryl at Array, representing you, not the insurance companies.
Say goodbye to 2018, hello 2019 with the Park Tavern. The Park Tavern is open both New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. Finish up your holidays with a relaxing and delicious breakfast with the Park Tavern family. It's a great time to get together with friends and family for a day of fun and relaxation. And of course, the Park Tavern will have all the football games on, so no matter what your team, they'll have you covered. On Louisiana Avenue, north of Highway 7 in St. Louis Park, ring in 2019 with the Park Tavern.
Why must the world be so cold? They've gone against what was told. Thinking rape is cool? Think about it. They think it's not wrong. Violence against women, the rape, the abuse, the emotional, physical. They all hold the hate. Think about it. Is it right or wrong? What attracts you? I'm not saying no names, but you laugh. Talk about it like nothing is wrong. Think about it. They all hold the hate. Gotta stop the violence. Stop the hate. Think about it.
Sponsored by the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition.
Be sure to pick up your copy of this month's Natural Awakenings magazine, a free local guide to a healthier and more balanced life. Each monthly issue includes timely, local, national, and global stories. Learn about alternative and complementary medicine, nutrition, fitness for body and mind, personal growth, sustainability, and much more. Natural Awakenings can be found at area health food stores, food co-ops, and retail locations. More information is available at naturaltwincities.com. That's naturaltwincities.com.
With your AM 950 weather, I'm Hunter Haas. Today, snow likely after 5 p.m., cloudy with a high near 33. Tonight, snow before midnight, then rain after midnight, low around 31. Thursday, rain, high near 38. EatLocalMinnesota.com is your way to find unique local restaurants offering one-of-a-kind food and atmosphere. Your choice is setting from casual to trendy. Great spots for date nights, evenings with friends, or business occasions. Make sure the money you spend stays local. Find out more at EatLocalMinnesota.com.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. We wanted to do a recap of Minnesota politics and maybe a little bit of a look ahead as we just get done with 2018 and a big year in Minnesota politics. Peter Callahan is the state government writer for MinPost. He's kind enough today to talk to us about 2018 and a little bit of a look ahead. Peter, thank you very much for the time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I want to start off with last session because there was, clearly, Kurt doubts that when he was Speaker of the House, and he still is, but he's going to be soon to be the House Minority Leader. But when he was Speaker of the House, his trick to try to get stuff passed with a Democratic governor, a process which was mimicked in many other states as well, I should mention, was to try to wrap up pieces of legislation that the governor wanted and the Democrats wanted in a bill that also was an amalgamation of other bills that they didn't want, that the Republicans were trying to use and utilize. It's a technique that you're trying to utilize the positive bills to get the negative bills passed in regards to the governor. And it was a technique that that Dowd has used, but this year with Omnibus Prime, it really went off the rails. Wouldn't you agree with that?
It's hard for me to know. I've not covered that legislature for as many years as other people have, but you know, the term log rolling goes back in American history well before even the birth of Kurt Dowd. and that's what you're describing, the concept of putting things in that I really want to vote for and forcing me then to give you the votes for things I don't like. That's why the state constitution has a single subject rule. And that subject must be reflected in the title. And legislators can quote that, but the courts in this state have not enforced that. So it's a long practice, and you can make the case, I think, that it reached a pinnacle at the end of 2018, but it's been around. Democrats have used it as well, and it is as non-transparent a method for legislating that I can imagine.
And you're right. Democrats have done this stuff in the past, and it is something that's not necessarily new. But the technique that was used here, I've talked to a lot of people that have been in the Capitol for a while, and they don't remember nearly as much. I mean, there were people in the Republican Party. There was a lot of Republican legislators who had no idea what was in that bill. That it was Kurt Dowd and Joyce Pepin and a handful of people would go into a room, and here's the bill, and they knew some of the concepts that were in there, but it was, there were even Republicans that weren't aware of it. It became a snowball rolling downhill. I mean, when you got to Omnibus Prime, it was, like I said, I've talked to Republicans who said there were a lot of things in that bill that had bipartisan support, the governor was ready to sign, that died because it was just looped in there with all the rest of that gunk. And it was just too big for its own good.
Yeah, it replaced what used to be referred to as the committee bill, which I think is almost as bad, but not quite as bad. And that would be that various committees would save everything up that had come to their committee and put it maybe or maybe not in their committee bill, which would also then have many subjects, again, things that you might like or things that you don't like. But as far as sort of public policy, I want to be able to track a bill. Mm-hmm. So I have a bill number. I go to the hearing. The hearing is held. No vote is taken at that hearing. The chair usually says, this bill will be held over for possible inclusion in the committee bill. That's as bad because I no longer have a bill number that helps me track that. I can't use data and use the House and Senate websites to track legislation. What happened with Omnibus Prime was a bunch of those committee bills, and maybe, there's 7 or 8 or 9 or 10, were all put into the one omnibus bill, which is why they called it this, whatever you want to call it, mega omnibus or omnibus prime. So this is, in fact, a continuation, but the problem is that if lobbyists and reporters and legislators can't figure out what's being passed, what chance does a regular citizen of Minnesota have?
And it was a trick. I mean, no one was really going in blindside. I mean, the previous year we had the light rail that was supposed to be in the bill. Republicans in both chambers had agreed to it. Kurt Dowd did the same thing. He pulled the Southwest Light Rail Line funding out of the bill. threw it at everyone. They didn't even have time in the House to see if it was in there. Ron Latz caught it in the Senate. And to give you an idea of even the disconnect within the Republican Party on that back then, Ron Latz said, oh, well, we forgot this bill and it needs to be added in. And it passed almost unanimously. I think it actually did pass unanimously in the Senate. And so it got sent back, but Kirk out because he didn't want Southwest Rail kind of, adjourn the House and ran out of the state capitol. They were all expecting something of this nature. I just think that, there's an element here. There is a fight between Doubt and the governor where it was kind of a bashing in the minds. And I just don't think Kurt ever got around to figuring out how to without doing it in a positive light, work around Governor Dayton to get what he wanted to do done.
Yep. I mean, that was a fraught personal relationship.
Yeah.
And you could sort of see it in how they respond to each other, how they talk about each other. That was a personal issue. The governor seemed to get along better with Majority Leader Gazelka than he did with Doubt, and they conflicted. And Dayton will, I think, be the first one to admit that he essentially lets people get his goat. And he lets himself be too riled and take things too personally. He was, I thought, with a couple of weeks left in session, making statements and taking positions that were not designed to reach a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And he jokes about how Tim Walz has got a better personality than he does, and wishes him luck in dealing with legislators of the other party, but I don't think you can dismiss a very, very toxic personal relationship between those two people.
And to give Kurt Doubt credit, I don't know if it's the right term, when you're looking at what his position was, and, Gazelka seemed to be going along with what he wanted to do for the most part, you don't really have many options if you're trying to get legislation passed. And I think from when you even look back on the years past where they tried to do the ballot initiatives that all failed, the gay marriage and the voter ID and stuff like that, and those failed. I mean, there weren't many paths for him to try to get stuff done. So, yes, it was grandiose, but really it was, if you're not going to work with the other side, it really was the only option he had left on the table.
Yeah, I guess. There are ways you pass bills individually and then the governor can veto them or not veto them. The way you describe it was a gamble, that rather than send him 10 bills and he vetoes 9 of them and signs the one he wants, you send them all in one package and roll the dice and hope that he's going to sign the whole thing because he wants a few things. And people on the Hill were surprised, I think, to some degree that the governor vetoed both that and the tax bill because it was killing a lot of legislation from opioid overdose issues to elder care to fixing some of the MNLARS problems with the private vendors, and they thought no Democrat would want to go out on the campaign trail having a role in killing all of those things. As it turns out, those really weren't issues in the campaign, at least generally, maybe district by district. And the state didn't fall apart, as near as I can tell. Last I checked, I'm not by a window. But it seems that none of that legislation was so vital that anybody but the people directly involved noticed.
And you bring up the election here, and it is interesting. You're right. It did not come back on the Democrats really in the least bit. When you look at the Republicans' issues in that election cycle, where would you begin? What would you say was their biggest problem? Was it Trump? Was it Omnibus Prime? Was it just the fact that the Democrats, and I talked to a lot of Democrats, especially in rural Minnesota, who very freely admitted, oh, yeah, this is the first time in 20 years someone's gone door knocking in many of these communities as the DFL. And, it's all of a sudden, wow, we're opening a door. There is this other party out in rural Minnesota. What do you think, in your mind, as you covered it, was the biggest problem for the Republicans in that election cycle?
It was a national election being fought on legislative district levels. Getting back to Speaker Doubt, he said early on in August when I was talking to him about the House races that he was hoping people would make a distinction between the president and even congressional candidates because they knew that they were having suburban problems with congressional candidates and vote differently once they got down to his folks. And that the entire campaign was based on ticket splitting. So they knew very well that they had a Trump problem, and they had a Trump problem especially in the suburbs around the Twin Cities, and that they had to separate their candidates from all that. And the doorbelling that you mentioned, done by AFL-CIO affiliates, done by Planned Parenthood, to some degree environmental organizations, was meant to link all that back up together. Because the district, the ledge districts that they worked the hardest on and had the most success in, were those ledge districts that are beneath the congressional district that Angie Craig and Phillips won. So that was coordinated so that they were realizing that these were the same voters, and they wanted them to vote straight ticket, and Doubt wanted them to ticket split.
And you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I don't ever remember, you know, I heard him say that, not just to you, but other people as well. We want people to, you know, you can go against this candidate, but make sure you always keep your options open. But yet it never really resonated, and it clearly was not a message that either the Republican Party itself or any of their the 501c3 groups, the dark money groups that are out there, really pushed this idea of you can vote Democrat in this race and Republican in this race.
Well, I think what he wanted you to say was vote Democrat for Congress and vote for Jennifer for legislature. Mm-hmm. Vote for this person who you know. These are 30,000 voter districts in Minnesota, the halves of the district that House members run in. Sounds like a lot of people, but it's not that many people. And he wanted them to say, I don't care that Jennifer or Sarah or Roz is a Republican. I just know Roz from PTA or from the grocery store. That's really what he was pushing for, that he wanted his folks to run as almost as individuals.
Oh, yeah.
And several of them, Jennifer Loon, I mentioned, Sarah Anderson, they had run and won in Democratic wave years. So the thinking was they were resilient enough to be able to do so again, and they were just swamped. And then, because the numbers are of interest to me, because you were talking about turnout and you were talking about efforts to drive turnout. I think I counted 9 different Republicans in suburban Twin Cities who lost despite getting more votes than they won with in 2014.
I know you're exactly right. Roz Peterson was one of them. I think Cindy Pugh was one of them as well. That they had the best numbers they ever had, and they just had no chance.
Yes, because it was a nationalized election, specifically in suburbs and specifically with women in suburbs. And I'm not sure, you know, a lot of Republicans walked away from the Jeff Johnson campaign after Pawlenty did not win the nomination because they thought, oh, we've got no chance with this guy. I don't think they had any chance with Pawlenty. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure who they could have run for a statewide office that could have won given the fundamentals of this election.
No, you're exactly right. And if you think about it, all those the Republican political signs, they weren't red. They were nondescript colors. They were green and purple and blue, and they never put Republican on their banners. They were trying their desperate hardest to basically not look like Republicans. And Dean Phillips, I mean, Dean Phillips was a pretty dang outstanding candidate. I'm not saying any particular, but when you look at people who have run for office, you have seen good Republicans, good Democrats, good candidates that win a district. And Dean Phillips just, Eric Paulson was in a deep hold when the minute that he became the candidate. And there was just, I think there are so many people that looked at Dean Phillips as the viable option that just was going to knock him out. When you talk about Jennifer Loon and Cindy Pugh and Sarah Anderson, I mean, all those people, they got taken out really by that Dean Phillips, the additional Dean Phillips momentum.
Right. There's a skill among candidates that is underappreciated, and that is calm. And that is the unlikelihood that they can be riled off of their position. And Phillips did that very well. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, although it didn't work as well for him, Jeff Johnson has that talent as well, in that he is just very even, does not allow the stuff that gets thrown at you to take you off message and to shift you too much. You can't ignore attacks, but you can overreact to attacks. And I don't think Phillips ever really overreacted to any of the attack that came from the R's.
That's excellent. That is just absolute excellent commentary on that. The statewide races, it really is kind of shocking. You know, you look at, I mean, let's look at the Keith Ellison and Doug Wardlow race. I mean, when the Democrats got done with the primary, the Republicans were like, okay, we're going to win that race because, you know, there is not necessarily within the Republican Party, but a lot of dark money groups that come on in, and it's like, you know, black Muslim man, that was going to be the narrative. And it was the narrative in outstate Minnesota. Yet even that race, you know, was a pretty, you know, it wasn't as nearly as close as I think people were expecting it to be. And, you know, yet when, here we are once again, the Democrats control all the statewide races.
Yeah, but Keith Ellison's campaign had to make an adjustment, and they did.
Mm-hmm.
If they had not made this adjustment, I think he well could have lost. And what they did was they, you know, I sort of facetiously say the campaign slogan became, yeah, but at least I'm not Doug Wardlow. That's what the campaign became, and it was almost completely within DFL circles. If you looked at some of the Star Tribune NPR polling late in that election, the undecideds in Hennepin and Ramsey County in Attorney General were double what they were for any of the other statewides. So he had a bunch of folks in his base, Hennepin and Ramsey County, who were reporting themselves undecided. It was 19% undecided in that last Star Tribune NPR poll. That's late. For everybody else, it was 9%, 6%, 7%. So what he realized, I think, is that I got to go get those undecided.
Mm-hmm.
For one of the first times ever, I think, a DFL campaign 2 weeks before the election was focused almost exclusively on DFL voters and DFL sympathists. Sympathetic voters. And so he brings in Erin Murphy, and she endorses him. He brings in LGBTQ community, and they endorse him. He brings in local city attorneys and former attorneys general to endorse him. Each one had the message that Wardlow was dangerous. And that, and then he got somewhat lucky. The DFL investigation did not corroborate. And then the court records that I'm sure he still is angry about, his divorce records being released, that they actually gave DFL voters the permission, I guess.
The cover, yeah.
Yeah, cover makes it sound like they, but it gave them some assurance that they weren't going to be voting for someone and find out later that there was bad stuff there.
I think
he won because he got those voters back.
Your point about that, I think that minute that Star Tribune and the Alpha News of subpoena of those records was opened up, that actually became a huge problem for the Republicans because, like I said, not only was he not a villain in that marriage, but he was the person that was the victim to a point. And there was no way they could back away from that at that point. And you're right. I think his game plan there was a pretty solid one. I want to, in the final few minutes here, if we can, though, I want to look a little bit towards 2019. Two major reasons. One, what do you think Tim Walz is going to do here as governor? I mean, obviously it's going to be changed from Dayton, but which direction do you think he's going to go?
Well, he will, he's a somewhat better personality in dealing with folks he disagrees with. And it was odd during the DFL primary, he was criticized by some for being a guy who could deal with the other side or could deal with business, or he could deal with Republicans, or he could deal with conservatives, and that was almost a negative in the primaries. That didn't take him out, and he reemphasized that during the general. So I think personal relationships can be important, and I think he may be better doing that. I think he will push many of the bills that he talked about, or the issues that he talked about in the campaign. I've got a piece running, a week or so ago, about the paid family leave. Paid family leave is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. If he could somehow convince Senate Republicans to take that to a vote, that would affect far more people than many of the things the legislature does. He will say, how he puts his agencies together. He wants them to be more conciliatory and more cooperative with those they regulate. But I think you will see most of the things. I think you'll see some some gun safety stuff coming out of him. He will push those issues that he ran on, and they may or may not get stuck in the Senate. Mm-hmm. But the Senate has a Senate Republicans have a suburban problem too. They have at least two senators who are going to face re-election in districts where both of the House seats went heavily for the DFL. So they're going to want to be pushing against those particular folks, putting pressure on them on family, paid family leave things, perhaps gun bills, transportation funding that includes transit. It'll be harder for Gazelka to hang on to a couple of those folks who won the election.
Agreed wholeheartedly. Their House will. Do you think the House will actually be able to get to a single bill, kind of resolution, or do you think it just in the way that you know bills are made, it's going to be too impossible for them to do?
You mean doing with the gun bills?
You don't know, just getting to a single, you know, kind of moving away from multi-issue bills and kind of doing what the Constitution says is that kind of doing the single
well,
issue.
Well, that's what Melissa Hortman pledged to do, and both Walz and Johnson in the campaign. Pledge that they would not sign these types of omnibus bills. But this is not the test for whether the DFL will stick with that. The test will be the next time they have both the House and the Senate. She can do all the, if she wanted to, and I don't think she does, she could send DFL omnibus bills to the Senate. They would either be ignored or they'd be broken apart. So I don't think that happens this session. I hope not, because it's really hard to cover. It's really hard to keep track of stuff when they do that. And Hortman has pledged not to.
It's a much more of a long litany of things every day there. So Peter Callahan from MinnPost covering state government, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today. Some great insight there. And please, I am desperately going to have you come back on my show at times and talk about politics, if that's okay.
Okay, you bet.
Thank you very much. Peter Callahan from MinnPost. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for over 45 years, invites you to shop through two convenient locations. Seward Co-op stores are committed to local producers and food you can feel good about serving your family and guests. Pre-order your holiday meal from Seward, local free-range Ferndale turkeys, handcrafted traditional vegetarian, vegan, and made without gluten sides, perfect for everyone at your holiday gathering. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store at 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop.
Toyota-thon is on. Head to Rudy Luther Toyota and check out the great deals. Rudy Luther has huge model year-end incentives, but it's the continued service which will make you a loyal Luther customer. Get 2 years maintenance free with every new Toyota purchased, performed in one of the largest volume service departments in the country. They'll never sell you service you don't need. Plus, the Luther Advantage card gets you great discounts at holiday. Go to RudyLutherToyota.com for all the Toyota-thon deals. Rudy Luther Toyota, 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
Turn to Auto Technical with your vehicle donation. We have families waiting for a car. You know, over 85% of unemployed are successful in finding and keeping a job if they have dependable transportation. A car plus a job equals a life changed. 612-919-5526. We have families waiting for a car. 919-5526 or autotech.org.
Peter Callahan, the Minnesota State reporter for MinnPost, an excellent point about the art of calm, one of the best analysis of politics locally I've heard all year long. Dave Durenberger as well. Thank you very much. A brand new to you show tomorrow as well. Thank you much. We're back on tomorrow. Till then, see ya.